actors have long accused Hugo Chavez of harboring active cells for the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah in Venezuela. It was alleged that Chavez provided safe haven to the only group which has successfully driven Israel out of Lebanon, the resistance group Hezbollah, in the Venezuelan territory of Margarita Island. The current Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, who himself has been the target of several U.S. assassination attempts, has publicly spoken of his close relationship with the late resistance leader, General Qasem Soleimani. Maduro claims that when Venezuela was subject to U.S. cyber attacks, it was Soleimani who came and secured Venezuela's systems from North American skullduggery. When asked about his country's commitment to the liberation of Palestine, Maduro responded, "No one in this world dares ask us to abandon Palestine. It is a sin just thinking about abandoning Palestine. Palestine is the sacred land of mankind. Israel's crimes against the Palestinian people will be paid for by the occupation one day." Despite Israel's best attempts to subvert the will of billions across the world, Palestine is not alone, and Latin America stands firmly with it.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller, who's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University. David's a director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's recently been appointed as a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zaim University. Our guest expert today is Pablo Navarrete. Pablo is a journalist and a documentary filmmaker. His work includes Inside the Revolution, A Journey into the Heart of Venezuela, and No Extradition, which traces the struggle of Julian Assange's father for his son's freedom. And we spoke to Pablo earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, which of the governments in Latin America, in your opinion, would you say have been, you know, the most supportive, stood out in their support for Palestine?
Well, as we heard in the film there, there's quite a lot of the Latin American countries have recognised the Palestinian state. And indeed, many of the countries who come from a tradition of struggle against authoritarianism, they're the ones who are most likely to be supporting the Palestinians. Obviously, Venezuela is a standout case, and the Venezuelans have been absolutely at the front of absolute support for the Palestinian cause, and indeed for the support of other armed movements around about West Asia, including in Lebanon with Hezbollah. The Chilean government recently, of course, the new Chilean leader sent back the new Israeli ambassador as a result of the killings of the IDF in the territories. And of course, even let's go further back. I mean, countries like Nicaragua and Cuba and indeed Bolivia more recently have been very supportive of the Palestinian cause.
Certainly set the standard, I think, for the rest of the world, in my opinion. But anyway, we asked Pablo about Chile's bond with Palestine and how deep it actually runs.
OK, so I'm the son of Chilean political refugees. I'm born and raised in the UK. Now, Chile is the country that has the biggest Palestinian population outside the Arab world. And there are between 300,000 to 500,000 Palestinians. It is estimated, and take into account that Chile has just under 20 million people, so it's not an insignificant population. Now, the roots of this population date back to the late 1800s, Christian enclaves around Bethlehem, Palestinians that left for Latin America, but principally the population in Chile came after the First World War, again, Christian predominantly. That settled in Chile, and initially it was a kind of more secular, progressively orientated in terms of politics population, but as it has embedded itself, many have done very well with business, and this population has become, in terms of at least of the representation, which is estimated to be about 6,000 Palestinians that form a kind of body, a Palestinian body that represent the community, which is, again, not much, 6,000 out of potentially 500,000, but this representative body is more conservative, has close ties to Chile's elite. So I think also interesting to think about is expressions of concrete solidarity with Chile. And here, I think it's worth mentioning the Palestinian Football Club of Chile's first division that was created in the 1920s and has... you know, if you go today to the stadium, you will see Palestinian flags, one of the only places where you'll see the Palestinian flag waved freely And, you know, chance of Gaza resists, Palestine exists.
David, Latifa referred to the legendary Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez in her report. I mean, just tell us what his stance was on Israel.
Well, Chavez was an uncompromising advocate of the Palestinian cause. And I think one of the things you've got to remember here is that the scepticism that there is on the left in Europe and parts of the world towards Islamic revolution is not held so strongly in Latin America. They come from a Christian background, predominantly Catholic, yes, but they're much more able to understand that religion can play a role in revolution than is the left in Western Europe, I think. And that's partly because of the role of the Christianity in liberation struggles in Latin America. So we see a much easier connection between Palestinian liberation and the liberation movements of Latin America. And that's something which, you know, Chavez, socialist that he was, understood very well.
Indeed. Well, I also asked Pablo to outline the attitude of the new Chilean government about Palestine.
In December 2021, a former student leader turned lawmaker, Gabriel Boric, won the Chilean presidential election, and he won it against a far-right politician who was the son of a Nazi army officer. Kast was the surname, and someone that openly said he still admired the fascist US-backed dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet that ruled between 1973 and 1990. So Gabriel Boric is someone that, as a lawmaker, has effectively supported levels of BDS, has come out denouncing Israel in the past. And his government, since March 2022, I was in Chile when he became president, has made a number of symbolic gestures, which I think are important, but perhaps shouldn't be overstated. There were credentials for the new Israeli ambassador that were essentially postponed in September after the latest killings by the Israeli government of Palestinians. But that, again, much was made of that. But 2 weeks later, Boric, the government, apologized and did accept the credentials.
David, what do we know about the links between Venezuela and Hezbollah, which, of course, as we know, has been proscribed in this country?
So the Venezuelans have been very supportive of Hezbollah, as they have of the Palestinians, and both Maduro and Chavez have said, you know, we will not be abandoning our allies, and these are people who they regard as comrades in arms, and not as terrorists or as Islamic fundamentalists, as many people on the left in Western Europe would say.
Mm. I mean, Latifa also referred to a character known as the Carlos the Jackal. What do we know about him? I remember there's quite a bit of publicity about him about 30 years ago.
So Carlos was one of these sort of fictional terrorists for the Western media, someone who's so bad that even the mention of his name was enough to get to the front page of the tabloid press. Now, of course, he was a Palestinian guerrilla, and you know, unlike many people in Western Europe, the people in Latin America who support Palestinian liberation weren't willing to just throw people under the bus because they were engaged in armed struggle. So that's the key thing. There's an unflinching ability to say, no, we stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Mm. It's curious, isn't it? Because, as I mentioned, there was lots of publicity, I remember, at the time. I mean, why do you think it is that the Western media sort of focus on a character like Carlos the Jackal?
Well, they have to create the idea that there are these individuals who are motivated by some kind of personal animus or by some kind of religious drive, and that these are people who are in some way mad. That's what the whole idea of terrorism really is that these people are committing terror against civilians, they will say. They're not engaged in struggle against military forces. And the problem with these people is not just that they have a belief and they're fighting in relation to what they regard as justice, but they are somehow mad, right? Mm. And that's the idea. That's why you have Carlos the Jackal. You have this name to indicate he's kind of like a serial killer. Like that's the way they want to make it. These are people are mad and bad, and not people who are motivated by a political motivation, which of course was the reality.
No, indeed. And of course, another legendary Latin American figure, Fidel Castro, of course, someone else who I think has stood out in solidarity, you know, with revolutionary struggles in Palestine.
That's right, in Palestine and indeed in other places. I remember, she, of course, travelled to Africa to support revolution there.
Che Guevara, of course, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'm just going to pause the conversation there now for a moment because we've got another quite shocking report, actually, about the relationship between the previous far-right president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, and the Israeli regime.
Many have questioned who the most pro-Israel Latin American leader has been. The winner of that dubious competition may well be former Brazilian president and military officer Jair Bolsonaro. It is believed that his emotional promotion of the Zionist project stems from his aim to ingratiate himself with his Christian evangelical electoral base. But Bolsonaro has gone over and above his servility to Israel. At Palestine Declassified, we question if Bolsonaro has facilitated the penetration of Brazil's armed forces by Israeli intelligence. Benjamin Netanyahu was the first Israeli political leader to visit Brazil following the election of Bolsonaro. He proudly hosted Netanyahu at a synagogue in Rio de Janeiro, where they announced a brotherhood between their countries with the intent of increasing economic, military, and technological integration. Bolsonaro bestowed upon Netanyahu the highest national honor for visiting political figures, and the Brazilian Post Office released a special stamp to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the Zionist entity, featuring a picture of Netanyahu next to the word Savior in Hebrew. Bolsonaro was in turn crowned with a Friends of Zion Award in occupied Al-Quds. The family bonds between the Bolsonaros and Israel are so strong that the former Brazilian president's sons have been pictured wearing IDF t-shirts, and his wife even delivered her vote in the most recent election wearing a t-shirt emblazoned with the Israeli flag. The most sinister part of this story is Bolsonaro's role in submitting the data of the Brazilian army to an Israeli cybersecurity company with an umbilical relationship to Israeli intelligence. In March 2022, the Israeli company CySource signed an agreement to train the Brazilian military in cyber defense. The CEO and founder of the company is Amir Barel, who is reported to have worked for Israel's external intelligence service, Mossad, before entering the private sector. He also previously worked with the Israeli spy company NSO Group, which developed the Pegasus software that has hacked the phones of journalists, human rights defenders, and politicians around the world. CySource is also part of the Israeli cyber companies consortium, led by the arms company Israel Aerospace Industries. The consortium was founded in 2016 by Israel's Ministry of the Economy to, quote-unquote, provide an overarching solution by Israeli cyber companies to the needs of different national-level cyber agencies. In addition to granting this deal to CySource, a Brazilian lieutenant from the military, Luiz Katsap, was appointed as the global sales director of the Israeli company. How can the Brazilian military protect its sovereignty from Israeli espionage?
David, would you say that Bolsonaro takes the award as the most pro-Israel Latin American leader probably in history?
Possibly in history. I mean, he is clearly very strongly pro-Israel. And you saw that his son's there with the IDF T-shirts and the Mossad T-shirts you could buy in Israeli airports as you travel into the country. I'm not sure if they sell them to just everyone, but they are certainly available. But let's think back in history. I mean, the Israelis have a strong record of intervening in Latin America. And back in the days when the military ran Argentina, there was a strong role there. The Israelis supplied weapons to the military dictatorship there, including in a period when the dictatorship was rounding up Jews. And the Israelis didn't balk at that. They still supplied the weapons. So there's been a long history of involvement. And, of course, what they're doing in Brazil now is trying to penetrate the Brazilian military to get the data. I mean, anyone who thinks that these cybersecurity companies are just there for business reasons, hasn't thought for more than 2 minutes about it. I mean, this is a conscious effort by Israeli intelligence to branch out into the corporate world and to use the corporate results for Israeli intelligence's own benefit. So, you know, certainly Bolsonaro is a very strong pro-Israel character, but he's not the only one by any means.
Well, I asked Pablo what he could tell us about the farcical Venezuelan opposition figure, Juan Guaido, and his relationship with Israel.
Yeah, Juan Guaido was a far-right, again, politician, a sort of a bit of a nobody, really, in Venezuela, known by only 20% of the population when it was decided by the US and others that he would be the latest attempt to effect regime change in Venezuela, something they've been trying since 1999 when Hugo Chavez first came to power. And obviously under Chavez, you know, support for Palestine and Palestinians' resistance against the savagery of Israel and what it does daily in Palestine went up many notches. And obviously Israel viewed Venezuela under Chavez as a threat. And so Guaido was this, you know, self sort of pathetic figure, really, that decided that he'd call himself the president with the support of the UK and the US and other sort of imperial states. And even though now the opposition have discarded him, he's still someone that the UK, I think, recognises as the president. It's all sort of farcical and pathetic. But he, you know, when he declared himself president in February 2019, he said he would restore diplomatic relations with Israel immediately, obviously, something that had been, you know, not been the case for 10 years prior under Chavez, broke diplomatic relations. He said he would open an embassy. And so he was really kind of, you know, very much a puppet for US imperialism, for what Israel is attempting also to do in the region. But really, he's just a sort of a washed out figure now that has no relevance, but, you know, continues to be, you know, thought of as some kind of president by people in London and in Washington.
David, what else can you tell us about CISORCE that was mentioned in the last package about Bolsonaro?
So CISORCE is a cyber defence company. We've seen on the show a number of different cyber defence companies and tech companies which have been, you know, rolled out of Israeli intelligence. And the plan clearly is, with all of these companies, is that you create these commercial vehicles, you staff them with ex-intelligence officers who then will have some kind of relationship with Mossad or even with Shin Bet internally in the Zionist entity. So if you look at it from the point of view of Mossad sitting in Tel Aviv, and they have all these different cyber defense companies and cybersecurity companies and tech firms, CISORCE is one of them, there's many others we've looked at in this program, what you see is the ability to try and penetrate the information infrastructure of different countries. In the UK, for example, we saw only the other week we did a show on Oracle, the Zionist firm in America, penetrating the Ministry of Defence in this country. And this is what CISORCE is up to in Brazil. It's about penetrating the data, which allows them to penetrate into the fabric of the running of the Brazilian society. And that's what they're doing in all the countries in which they're engaged. Mm.
And, of course, Bolsonaro's a former military officer, isn't he? And I just wondered, do you think it's possible that he's opened his country up to Israeli espionage then?
Well, this is obviously what the Israelis are trying to do. They try and do it in the UK and the US, which are their notional allies. And, of course, they'll do the same in Brazil. If Brazil thinks it's just an ally and they're going to work together, well, no. I mean, they're going to be penetrated, and the Israelis will use that to their own advantage, either to project their own power in Latin America or to gain power against and subvert the Brazilian state itself. So, you know, as we're now in a position where Lula is the new president of Brazil, you know, what's going to happen with those contracts? I mean, if Lula knew what he was doing, he would, of course, have cancelled these contracts and removed the Israelis straight away, but that hasn't happened yet.
No, indeed. Of course, the thing is, though, I mean, has Bolsonaro facilitated it, though? I mean,
Of course he has. I mean, once you get these contracts in place and you appoint Brazilian military people to the boards of the companies, you're fusing together Israeli foreign policy interests and the security interests of the security state in Brazil.
And finally, David, I mean, looking ahead, how do you think the Palestinian and Latin American relations will develop in the years ahead?
Well, I mean, you have to think about this in terms of how you think the revolution in Palestine is going to develop. And from my point of view, it looks like we're entering into a new intense phase of resistance in Palestine, with the possibility of the full liberation of Palestine within the next few years. Mm. And that will mean that there will be an increasing need for solidarity, but also an increasing desire to give solidarity, because what happens usually in these sort of scenarios, whether it's an anti-colonial revolution or an anti-settler colonial revolution, is that once the liberation movement comes closer to liberation, that the support rallies all around the world. And you saw that with South Africa, you saw that in relation to a number of other colonies, Algeria. So what we'll see is, with Latin American countries, is especially those which are already supporting Palestine, that their support will intensify and it will be added to by other countries which will come on board.
Mm. Do you think it's significant that, that solidarity is more pronounced in former, countries that were former, subject to, colonisation by Western powers?
I don't think it's just that they're subject to colonisation, but it's that they have their own immediate history of having to win their freedom through armed struggle. And that's the key clincher, isn't it? People understand that you've got to fight, if you're going to overthrow military dictatorships. And people in Western Europe don't really have that history. We don't, not in the last 50 years. No, whereas people in other parts of the world do have that history.
No, indeed. Well, I'm afraid the clock's beaten us again today, so we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank our guests, Pablo Navarrete, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you. Don't just leave it there. The stories and scrutiny that we provide are being suppressed by corporate media and big tech. So help us to beat the censorship by sharing today's programme on social media. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
With only 64 X-ray and 73 kidney dialysis machines, 7 CT scanners and 1 MRI, combined with West cruel sanctions against the quake-hit Syrians, doctors in northwest Syria are racing against the clock to treat 8,500 injuries. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Nature wrote in this regard, the 7.8 magnitude earthquake that struck Turkey and Syria on February 6th has killed more than 50,000 people and flattened multiple cities. More than 4,500 of those who died and 8,500 injured are in northwest Syria. Its already depleted healthcare system, 4.7 million people share just one MRI machine, is on its knees. More than 10,000 buildings are completely or partially destroyed, leaving 11,000 people homeless, according to the United Nations Humanitarian Agency, OCHA. The earthquake also destroyed warehouses that store medicines. Hospitals in this region have been overwhelmed as they attempt to accommodate thousands of injured people in spaces with severely limited beds, medical supplies, surgical equipment, and intensive care facilities. More than 8,500 injured people need to be accommodated in only 66 functional hospitals, providing 1,245 beds for short hospital stays, according to the WHO. Moreover, all of northwest Syria has just 86 orthopedic surgeons, 64 X-ray machines, 7 computerized tomography CT scanners, and 1 magnetic resonance imaging MRI machine across the region. According to WHO, compiled data published towards the end of 2022. The region's critical lack of health care is partly caused by hospitals and medical staff being targeted during the war, explains Ek Zayes, who is a co-investigator on a UK-funded project called Research for Health System Strengthening in Syria. In a separate study, Ekayes estimated that as of June 2021, 350 medical facilities had been attacked and 930 healthcare personnel killed. AKS says people are running all over the place to make use of any existing resources, including basic ambulances. The medical staff have been working nonstop, adds Habusa, who is working at the maternity hospital in Idlib when the first earthquake hit at 1:17 Universal Time. The hospital occupies the fifth and sixth floors of a building. Habusa said, "We had to evacuate the incubators and move all the babies to the ground floor." According to three doctors who Nature spoke to in northwest Syria, the most common injuries are limb fractures, trauma injuries, crush injuries including crush syndrome, damages that result in organ dysfunction including kidney failure and bleeding. People with crush syndrome need intensive care and dialysis, says cardiologist Jawad Abu Hatab, who is Dean of Medicine at Aleppo University in northwest Syria. However, the region has only 73 renal dialysis machines, according to the WHO compiled data. Abu Hatab adds there were also cases of cardiac arrest from the shock and horror of catastrophe. The medical community is also preparing to deal with more cases of post-earthquake trauma, especially among children and women. Doctors say they urgently need more dialysis machines and orthopedic surgery equipment, along with painkillers and antibiotics. These supplies were not abundant before the earthquake and will now run out, says Habusha. Truthout wrote in this regard, the devastating earthquake in Turkey and Syria has killed many people. The destruction is unfathomable. According to the UN, at least 870,000 people across Turkey and Syria are in urgent need of hot meals. In Syria, around 5.3 million people are in need of shelter. And over 1 million people in Turkey are living in temporary shelters. It feels like another punch in the gut after the horrors and anguish Syrians have already endured through years of war, displacement and sanctions. Heartbreaking stories have emerged from Turkey and Syria. In one widely shared image, photographer Adam Alton memorialized the anguish of a father as he sat alone amidst the rubble holding onto his deceased 15-year-old daughter's hand. Stories of rescue have also ignited flickers of hope amid such profound despair. The earthquake is the latest crisis within a larger crisis in Syria, already fractured over a decade now. Over 300,000 people have been killed there since the war broke out in 2011. Prior to the earthquake, an estimated 6.7 million people were already internally displaced. Millions more were impoverished by U.S. and European sanctions designed to strangle the economy. Additional U.S. sanctions since 2020 have targeted key sectors, including the central bank, oil, energy, and construction. They have also blocked food, medicine, medical equipment, and other necessities. 90% of Syrians now live in poverty, and 12 million are food insecure. With more than half of Syria's infrastructure either destroyed or severely damaged by war, sanctions have made reconstruction and economic recovery impossible. This was the situation before the earthquake struck. Months earlier, UN envoy Alina Duhan called for an end to sanctions, saying, "I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding and reconstruction," she said. Her recommendation has even greater urgency today. In a de facto admission that sanctions are hurting civilians, the U.S. Department of Treasury recently agreed to open a 180-day window authorizing transactions related to earthquake relief efforts in Syria. Although a welcome development, it's only a short-term reprieve from these sanctions' far-reaching catastrophic impacts. For the U.S., maintaining these failed sanctions while pledging to be a partner to the people of Syria is contradictory and counterproductive. They should be permanently lifted to allow Syrians the chance to finally catch their breath and begin to rebuild from these crises with dignity. The U.S. and international community must also redouble their diplomatic efforts toward ending the war instead of prolonging it. Tragedy should transcend political divisions, not reinforce them. According to RT, the effects of the devastating 7.8 magnitude earthquake, which hit both Turkey and Russia earlier this month, are being compounded by Western sanctions. But despite a temporary relaxation of restrictions on the war-torn and shaken country, problems still exist. Syrian provinces have still been left ill-prepared to deal with the scale of disaster that has befallen them and must now be given every support to reconstruct their country. According to the authorities in Turkey and Syria, as many as 50,000 people have been killed by the devastating earthquake, with at least 23 million people affected in total. Millions have been temporarily displaced, and many more still await news on their loved ones and whether or not they survive. The situation, as it stands, is another utter disaster, and the full impact is impossible to convey in mere words. In Turkey's case, the international community's response was unanimous. Aid was pledged, teams arrived to relieve the suffering, and whatever the political frictions between Istanbul and some Western nations, a sense of universal humanitarian camaraderie prevailed. The Biden administration in Washington reacted to the natural disaster by pledging anything that Ankara needed, while the European Union mobilized emergency response and offered its Copernicus satellite mapping service to help first responders in Turkey. However, the situation has been very different for Syria, with only a few select nations quick to come to its aid. The U.S. regime stated that it would not cooperate with Damascus to deal with the carnage inside Syrian territory. The Syrian government officially requested help from EU, which some EU states instantly refused to provide. The UK quickly came to aid of their NATO ally Turkey but refused help to the suffering Syrians. And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted his condolences to Turkey and his people in Turkish but failed to acknowledge Syria at all. Syrians were not in the spotlight to receive help from the West and are actively being ignored in spite of the gravity of the situation facing them.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the geopolitical situation in West Asia with strategic analyst Sharmeen Narwani. But first, let's take a look at this brief analysis.
The world is experiencing fundamental changes in the global power constellation. And as the geostrategically most important region in the world, West Asia is in the middle of these historic transformations. Like other regions in the world, it's experiencing major economic problems related to inflation and the combined aftereffects of the global COVID pandemic, US mismanagement of the global economy, and more than 20 years of a devastating global war by the US in the name of the so-called War on Terror. The world is only now coming to understand the profound significance of the historic defeat that the US and its allies experienced in West Asia in the early 21st century, in Iraq, in Syria, and in Afghanistan, which some have suggested was a third world war by historic standards, and which effectively ended any claims of the US to global hegemony and began a reordering of global affairs by the victors. But who were the winners of this Third World War? The Islamic Republic of Iran, with its allies in the various resistance movements of the region, joined later by a resurgent Russia and a rising China, who are all now in the process of creating a new global order with its own institutions, independent of the West, for the first time in centuries. This is turning out to be a big test for many local elites in West Asia, who have staked their continued worldly power and existence on US and Western backing. And we are already witnessing their desperate efforts to quickly reorient themselves towards these new powers in order to save their illegitimate tribal and military dictatorships. What's clear to most observers is that West Asia will be very different at the end of the year 2023 than it is at the beginning of the year 2023.
Sharmeen Narwani, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. You are the editor-in-chief and columnist of the Cradle online magazine, which deals with, which focuses on the geopolitics of West Asia, and you recently launched the Arabic language edition. I'm very happy that we're able to do this conversation. I follow your publication, and there are a lot of excellent analysis and articles and news items in there. Always, a good place for people to go to if they want to know what's going on in West Asia. And so we're going to take this opportunity in this conversation to look at a more broad analysis of, make a more broad analysis of what's happening in West Asia. There's a lot of interesting things happening. Your publication also talks about the new year, 2023. You have some of your columnists and your contributors making predictions, making some analysis. So we can start wherever you want. I can suggest, if you like, with your permission, we start with the very interesting article that you had in your publication. related to the way in which the Americans are basically blackmailing Iraq, because in terms of the money that they, the oil money, the oil sales money that the Iraqis have to send to the U.S., and that the U.S. is basically, you know, blackmailing the Iraqis. If you could give us a little insight into that story, and we can start there and go to other places later.
Well, you know, there are quite a few countries in the region now that are experiencing severe economic downturns. And right. Some of these are natural because governments have not planned ahead. Governments borrow money excessively, whether for the IMF or allies in the region and abroad. And they don't really have programs. There's a lot of corruption. So, but what's happening recently, I think in the last few years, is an escalation of the sanctions tool, the U.S. sanctions tool,
right,
to bring even allies into line mm-hmm. with U.S. Policy ambitions in the region. And the most recent, I mean, Turkey's experienced this, for instance, a NATO
correct.
Ally.
Correct.
Most recently, we're seeing this in Iraq. And what happened recently is that about 19 Iraqi banks were sanctioned. That decreased the central bank sales of dollars by about 40%, mm-hmm. which led to a huge decline in supply mm-hmm. And a huge decline in the ability for banks to transfer dollars. You would have to wait a minimum of 15 days now to transfer dollars anywhere. Part of this was to get a handle on the dollars that were moving in the Iraqi market, particularly outside of Iraq, to countries like Iran, Syria, mm-hmm. and Lebanon. So right. these particular screws that were put on Iraq specify Lebanon as one of those target countries
right.
where dollars are being contained. But I think, you know, this article that we wrote was, it went viral. I think even Iraqi journalists, we don't see a lot of light shining on
that's right.
issues that are of huge importance to the economic independence and political independence of the country. Seems like Iraqi politicians themselves, no matter what side, do not want to discuss the nitty-gritty. And an example of this is that our article shines a light on the fact that since 2003, the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, mm-hmm. All Iraqi oil revenues mm-hmm. must be sent to a single bank account in the United States, okay? Not multiple, not dollar accounts in Singapore or in Europe or anywhere. One single bank account in the United States. This is by the occupying and invading entity.
Right.
And all these years later, exactly 20 years later, this practice continues. And this is a key point of leverage that the Americans continue to exercise over all Iraqi political decisions. If you don't do this, we will not release your oil revenue dollar supply in our bank, right?
Right.
But this is something like you're hard-pressed to find Iraqi politicians, again, on both sides of the political aisle or all sides of the political spectrum, to address this very critical issue. How can Iraq use its dollars, use its oil revenues to invest in infrastructure, key infrastructure that is severely affecting the population, like access to water, electricity, et cetera. You know, we've seen protests about these kind of things. How can they do that when they don't control their revenues? So I think this is a very important thing, and we hope in the next few weeks and months to delve deeper into the subject and try to get Iraqi politicians on the record about, and this issue on the table in Iraq. You know, why is our money there, and how do we diversify it so that we have right. control over our revenues?
That's very interesting you mentioned that, because, you know, everybody probably remembers that during the sanctions before the American invasion, there was the famous oil for food program, mm-hmm. which, you know, didn't really do much for the Iraqis even at that time. But it seems that this is just a continuation of that. And then, of course, we have that famous photograph of Senator Tom Cotton, who was a an American officer in the Iraq War, sitting on this pile of gold bars from the Iraqi Central Bank, which apparently, this was reported at that time. I haven't seen any reporting after that. But at that time, it was reported that basically all the gold reserves were shipped off to Canada after the invasion. So it seems that, you know, this whole occupation that the Americans had was very much that old school mercantilist, you know, colonialist, imperialist strategy: get the oil, get the gold, and not really caring about other things. And so it seems that maybe Iraq, until this is solved, until this is resolved in some way, is not going to be able to be a normal country and deal with other countries, as we've seen, for example, with some of the cases that it had with Iran. Is there anything else you might want to add to that?
Do you know, I think what's happening is very critical here, because, I mean, this has been going on for absolute decades. It's not a recent thing, but right. There has always been Western efforts to shutter the borders between Iran and Iraq, between Iraq and Syria.
That's right.
Between Syria and Lebanon. And that continues. I mean, you actually have U.S. troops stationed at the Syrian-Iraqi border to
exactly.
inhibit the flow of goods and, transportation vehicles and whatever for the last number of years.
We just had that recent attack on the Iranian convoy that was sending, you know, diapers and the gloves, the sanitary gloves.
Yes. And, you know, we have a new Iraqi prime minister, Prime Minister Sudani, and he comes in as a nominee of the more pro-Iran elements
right.
Of the Iraqi body politic. And so he's an unknown factor. The previous prime minister, Mustafa al-Kazemi,
right.
was pretty much, you know, towed the American line on all things. Prior to him, you had Adel Abdel Mahdi.
Right.
And he was very interesting because he was doing some unusual things in Iraq. Just before the October protests broke out in 2019
yes.
and basically, scuttled all political movement, development, economic, political,
right.
you know,
yes.
movements, et cetera. And one of the things he did was open officially mm-hmm. the Iraqi-Syrian border.
That's right.
The other thing he did was he signed an agreement with the Chinese, basically an oil for infrastructure
right.
deal. And a couple of other things like that within a short space of time, which absolutely, raised all kinds of alarms for the Americans.
Right.
And then within no time, you had the October protests. And this is how they do. They can create domestic strife in countries. They can sanction entities. They can use financial tools to destabilize the national currency.
Right.
They can set off a fire or a bomb here and there. But to me, it seems that these are the only tools left in the U.S. policy toolbox. They
right.
are not going to engage in a war or fan the flames towards a war because they cannot afford this. Their sights are firmly set on the Russian theater.
Right.
With the Chinese one not far behind. I mean, many American policymakers argue that China's number one. Why are we wasting our time on Russia? And then there are those who take a flip view. But for right now, West Asia can pretty much assure itself that there's not going to be any major hot war in the region, but we are going to have plenty of troubling instigations, sabotage,
right.
Efforts to buy off people and to sway perceptions, that kind of thing, you know, but the toolbox is very small these days for the Americans. But I think Iraq is a perfect example of a recently targeted state, and it comes as a warning to Sudani, who, as I said, was, it was a nominee from the sort of a pro-Iran coalition in Iraq, to not rock the boat too much. And, you know, sure enough, Sudani made a statement about a week or two ago saying he's not troubled by U.S. troops stationed in the country, et cetera, which I didn't take very seriously because his role ultimately is to balance Iran and the U.S. which is unfortunate because an Iraqi prime minister's role should not be to balance these two countries.
Right. Exactly.
It should be to pave a pathway for Iraq's economic development. You know, and
yeah, what are Iraq's national interests?
I mean, in Iraq, in Lebanon, they're treading water.
Right.
And I mean, there's a point to that. You know, I don't particularly think much of the slow bloodletting that happens. You know,
right.
These sanctions on Syria are absolutely oppressive, on Iran, now on Iraq, on Turkey, on, you know, Egypt's economy. Why are we all treading water instead of carving a new path together?
Well, it's very interesting you mentioned that, because it seems to me that what you're talking about is really a problem of the elites of those countries, they not having the power to be able to define their own national interests. You know, of course, Iran, the big exception in this case, you know, having a revolution, having an independent system of governance, no matter what one might want to criticize, and there are things to criticize about Iran, but it is an independent country. It makes its own decisions based on its national interests. So you mentioned Egypt. There's a lot to talk about Iraq. We could go on for the whole program. So let's move to Egypt. You were talking about how, you know, a lot of the economies in the region are experiencing problems. And, of course, Egypt is maybe, you know, experiencing the worst economic crisis, you know, in a very long time. There was this very secret under the radar, your publication reported about it, this very secretive under the radar summit of leaders of some Arab countries in the Emirates, of course, without the presence of the Saudis and the Kuwaitis. And it seems the King of Jordan was there, the Egyptian leadership was there, and it seems that the main focus was trying to basically, you know, save Egypt from this social economic catastrophe that's looming there. If you could please, you know, share some insight into this issue with us.
Well, the columnist Abdel Bari Atwan, who wrote that
very
piece,
famous columnist.
He's wonderful. He didn't know the answers to why there was an emergency summit called for the next day,
right,
that required the attendance of heads of states, not only heads of states of Egypt and Jordan, but of four of the GCC countries. So he had to analyze what potentially was the subject under discussion and came up with two things. One was, you know, King Abdullah flew over,
right,
and suddenly you had this meeting. So what that could suggest, for instance, is because in Egypt the previous day, the meeting was included the Palestinian head of state. King Abdullah had been...
Right, King Abdullah of Jordan.
King Abdullah of Jordan had been attending,
right,
a meeting that included Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas.
Correct.
And we know recently there's been a lot of concern about the status of Jerusalem and the new right-wing Israeli government's,
that's right,
efforts to depopulate Jerusalem of Palestinian residents and to also, you know, attack Al-Aqsa Mosque and potentially destroy it. So, and King Abdullah of Jordan has voiced significant concern because he is viewed as the custodian of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Jerusalem,
right,
and fears that that status is about to be taken out from under him. So that was one potential topic of discussion. And the other one was Egypt's economy. I mean, we're talking about the entire collapse of the state, the inability for Egypt to address the most basic services,
right,
in its country. And the IMF has said that Egypt needs $40 billion in immediate aid. Otherwise, the state's collapse is imminent and inevitable. So,
right,
traditionally, Egypt, I think since the beginning of the Arab Spring, has taken in financial assistance from Persian Gulf countries to a much larger amount than $40 billion. But Persian Gulf countries recently, and perhaps this is why the Saudis and Kuwaitis didn't attend, the Kuwaiti parliament took a decision not to give Egypt any more aid. And the Saudis have now announced, I think we heard at Davos recently, that there will be no unconditional aid anymore,
mm-hmm,
to anyone, okay?
Right.
So, you know, so I think these were two potential topics under discussion at the secretive meeting in Abu Dhabi. But, you know, I don't know if this was such an important meeting after all. There are these kind of meetings that are taking place all the time. Right. There's a lot of troubleshooting going on in this region. There are a lot of plans afoot. And there are a lot of shifting alliances, you know. Right. And this is what's important, not just between regional states, but between great powers and the region. So we right. see in the Persian Gulf, for instance, now the Saudis and Emiratis, who were the key players in the GCC, the key decision makers and drivers right. of GCC policy, stepping up their relations with China and Russia, right. and brushing off American attempts to force them into oil pricing and oil production that doesn't benefit these countries. So we're seeing more independent foreign policies emerge under the younger leadership of in the GCC. And so it's there's no enmity. They're not taking sides between the US and Russia and China now. Right. They're exploiting all opportunities. They're being opportunistic, which is how politics should be in right. a way. You do what benefits you. But then regionally, of course, you have crazy shuttle diplomacy being, taking place for the last few years. The Turks, after being fully isolated in the region, and this comes a mere 10 years after being absolutely lauded by Arab leaders in the region for its policies and its good neighborliness, having realized how isolated they were, have ventured to deal, try to reopen relations with Egypt and with the UAE and others in the region, and the Saudis. The Saudi and Iranian rapprochement, for instance, and right. the Emiratis and the Iranians and the Qataris and the Iranians, and it goes on, and the Qataris within the GCC, and of course Turkey with Syria. So we're seeing a lot of troubleshooting going on in shuttle diplomacy. The question is, will it arrive at anything? And when it does, what are the alliances going to look like in the region? Right. You know, what are the things that will drive these alliances? It usually is for something, economy, for instance,
right.
or geopolitical play, and these can shift very easily because, if you look at any of these countries, you will have a domestic reasons for making decisions, and then right. you will have regional ones, and then you have international ones. So I see in this year a lot of shifts depending on things that rise in the region. But I think everyone's keeping doors open now because they have learned that closing doors is not leading anyone in this region to a better place.
Right. So it seems to me that the overarching title of this could be just the fact that, American hegemony is kind of, on the decline, that that there's a feeling among those who were maybe the closest allies of the U.S. that the U.S. can no longer yeah. support their family rule the way it used to in this unconditional way. We saw, for example, the way that the Yemenis were able to really pound the Saudis in a way that nobody expected. And mm-hmm. there were at times when you literally had the Yemenis striking back deep into Saudi territory. And of course, the Americans not doing anything about it. So let's talk a little bit about this changing, this what the Saudis really are after. It seems to me it's always about the Al Saud. It's always about keeping the Saudi family in power. We have these, things that they do. They allow Halloween and they allow pop concerts so that the young people don't, God forbid the young people should ask for, a elected government there, or somehow the Al Saud not being able to, no longer ruling there, having actually an elected government of some form there. So let's talk about this idea that the Saudis are attempting to, the Al Saud are attempting to kind of, continue their dictatorial rule, but maybe this time with the support of the Chinese or with some other country. And how feasible is that really? Because if we see their whole rule was based on the Americans really, bringing them to power and keeping them in power.
Well, you know, many states come into being for a reason, but then after generations, take a life of their own, you know, create their own reasons to be, reasons to exist. You know, I always think of Jordan during the reign of King Hussein. You know, Jordan is not resource rich. Its main resource is its human resource, which it generously lends out to Gulf countries and other countries in the region. So he had to make this state, Jordan, which had no relevance and no real borders, you know, before established by